This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Earl Swift. He's the author of Autobiography, and it's important to make the distinction between autobiography and autobiography. It's about a classic car, an outlaw motorhead, and 57 years of the American dream. How are you, Earl?
Doing great, Dave.
I love the book. It was, you know, for me, because I love cars, I'm kind of interested in Americana and the people that inhabit America. So this is really a perfect book. Maybe you could talk a little bit about, first we'll talk about you, and then we can talk about the book. You're primarily a journalist, correct?
Well, yeah, I'm entirely a journalist.
I guess the distinction, you know, maybe it shouldn't be drawn, you know, because journalists who write books are still journalists.
Yeah, it really kind of chaps me when I hear former journalist Earl Swift. Yeah, I worked for newspapers for 30 years, started making the transition to books about a dozen years ago, and this is my fifth. But, you know, the job is essentially the same. It's just that the stories are a bit longer. It really hasn't... I have not hung up my reporting, you know, my reporter's notebooks by any means.
Well, but the story is a lot longer.
this one's 108,000 words.
Right. And it's a great, maybe you could talk a little bit about this particular story. I know part of the story is your connection to this particular, the book revolves around a guy named Tommy Arnie. And you had written about him, you wrote a piece about him in a newspaper, you know, considerably long before you wrote the book.
Oh, yeah, before I even knew that this was a story. It dates back to 1993. In December of that year, I was a reporter for the Virginian Pilot in Norfolk, where I worked for 22 years. And I was assigned to go over to a go-go bar that Mr. Arnie owned at that point, a place called The Body Shop, which combined two of his passions, naked women and souped-up classic cars. He, in addition to having dancers in various states of undress up on stage at The Body Shop, he also had a classic car that he rotated in and out of the place that was on a turntable that would spin slowly under spotlights behind a picture window near the pool table. Anyway, I went over there because Tommy had been in a dispute with the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, which had an arcane regulation on its books that said that he could not serve hard liquor in the presence of a woman's exposed midriff or buttocks. And as those were central to his business model, he felt that he was being constitutionally deprived and took the state to court and prevailed against all expectation. Everybody's told him, you know, Tommy, you're never going to be able to beat the ABC at this, you know, that it's just it's a no-win proposition. And he was not daunted by that advice. And after several years, finally, the state folded its hands and Tommy prevailed. So I went over there to talk to him about it. And I just remember, you know, you step into the kind of the perpetual twilight of a go-go bar or strip club, and the music was excruciatingly loud, but pumped through a really good sound system. And Tommy and I took up tables by the stage. And he was just an enormous pro wrestler looking guy with black ringlets that spilled down halfway down the middle of his back and gargantuan arms. And he was wearing a tank top, even though it was 2 days after Christmas. And he utterly charmed me. I spent a couple of hours talking to him and was sorry that the interview ended. He was just, it was clear that he didn't have much education, but it was equally clear that he was a really smart guy. I just remember when I left thinking, you know, I hope I cross paths with that guy again, because he was just a lot of fun to talk to. And it's a truism that, you know, Tommy Arnie he's a rough customer. He's a memorable character in the book because he, you know, if you're with Tommy Arnie, you're either having a great time or getting your ass whipped. there's very little in between. And he's been arrested 70-odd times. He's a felon. He's a fifth-grade dropout. He's got a lot of credentials that would suggest that he's not polite society, and indeed he isn't. But it was his intelligence that I really took away from that interview as memorable. And 11 years later, having driven a succession of awful cars throughout my 20s, and often wondering while I drove them whether they had ever been worthwhile pieces of machinery or were always the tragic wrecks that they were by the time they came into my hands, I got to thinking that it might be an interesting story to try to find one old car and trace it back through everyone who had owned it and put together a bigger story. I wasn't sure what that bigger story would be at that point, but a story that spoke to something bigger than just cars, told through this otherwise unconnected fraternity of people who had owned it. I figure I'd get a pretty good, if not a cross section of America, at least a mosaic of the country, if I found a car that had been around long enough to have passed through a bunch of hands. And I figured, yeah, at a minimum, it needed to pass through six or seven, preferably more, but you know, seven hands would at least give me kind of the breadth of ownership experience that I hope to get through this story. And so that's how it started. In 2004, I began looking around for a car that I could trace back, first of all, and then, you know, a car that would prove to be a good candidate for a story like this. And got in through a mixture of a little bit of detective work and an awful lot of luck, had this 1957 Chevy 210 Townsman station wagon fall into my lap that at that point had been owned by 11 people.
And you were able to, and as you said, you were able to track and trace all of the 12, or at that time, all of the 11 owners of the car, which is a considerable feat, because many times older cars, the chain of ownership is so easily broken.
Well, not only do cars pass among owners without any documentation. I mean, a lot of cars, you know, people don't title them. But the other problem is that there is no good paper trail, even for those cars that are fully titled, because, you know, record keeping is not like it is for houses, for real estate. You can't go down to the county courthouse and pull the deed transfers on a piece of property and trace it all the way back to, you know, the days of George III. It's most states shred their records, or they did in the pre-digital days. After a couple of title transfers or a handful of years, whatever was longer, they just didn't have the space to stockpile the enormous amount of paperwork that auto ownership generates. And so what I found very quickly, you know, the idea sounded great to my editors when I pitched it to them. And then it wasn't until after I had pitched it and I was committed to attempt the story that I learned that DMV in Virginia pretty much had nothing on any car that was more than 5 years old. I mean, it just didn't have, there was nothing there.
Right. So you had, in order to find out, you have to talk to one owner. Where did you buy the car? Then the one before, if you can find the one before, then you go, but people die and move away and they can't remember. And there's so many things that make it hard.
Well, I've owned 10 used cars. I can probably name two of the people who have sold those cars to me over that time. You know, I mean, it's just right. Who remembers?
Right. No, it's it. That was an amazing part of the story. Now, of course, once you put together this car as the potential, let's say, lens around, you know, through which to tell the story, I take it from that then the accident of discovering that Tommy Arney was one of the owners, or was at that time the owner, made a difference to you.
Right. When I did the story for the paper, like I said, the car had been owned by 11 people, and Tommy had not yet come onto the scene. And I thought about turning it into a book. And what I found was that while it worked really well as a newspaper series, it ran in five parts the week after Christmas in 2004. It did not work well as a single story for which you needed sufficient forward propulsion to get a reader through 100,000 words. It just, what I wound up with was 11 discrete tales bound by the car.
Right. But not enough of a drama.
Not enough of a main character. No one of the 11. And really, it had to be the last of the 11 to drive the story because you're building towards the end. But none of those 11 people, interesting and wonderful, though each of them was, and very generous to me, none of them was sufficient. You know, they didn't have the critical mass to drive a story of this size. And so I set it aside and really had no intention of coming back to it. I figured it was dead. And then I was substitute teaching for a buddy in the spring of 2007. He taught a class in feature writing at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, and got called out of town, asked me to fill in for him. I went in, and on the syllabus that week, I was supposed to talk about documentary evidence. How do you use paper, you know, and where do you find it to help you tell feature stories? You know, how do you report documents? And as a prop, I brought along a city directory, which is a style of phone book that is used by reporters when they don't know someone's name, but they know where the person lives. You use this to find who lives at a certain address. You use it if you have a phone number but don't have a name attached. You can get a name that way through a city directory. It's a handy piece of equipment that's kind of been eclipsed a bit by the internet, but for 100 years before the digital age came upon us, it was kind of a basic tool that you'd see in every big city newsroom. And the kids, of course, were fascinated by the city directory. The idea that there was this analog book like this that did so much that their, you know, great grandparents could have used. And I, by way of explaining how useful it was, I described how I used the city directory to close part of the ownership gap on the 57 Chevy story, by now 3 years before, or two and a half. And, after the class, this young hipster with a 3-day growth of beard approached me and said, "You know that car you were talking about?" And I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Well, my dad owns it now, and he says he knows you." I said, "Really? Who's your dad?" And he said, "His name is Tommy Arnie." And as soon as the words left his lips, I knew I had a book to write.
Oh, that's great. Well, and of course, so at that point, I assume that Tommy became the focal point of your story, because most of the book, I mean, at least the beginning of the book is about Tommy much more than it's about the car, any kind of car. You know, you have to go back and tell his story, which is pretty incredible.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's that the biography of the title really refers probably to him as much as it does to the Chevy. You know, and they make a good pairing. They're the same age. They're from the same place, essentially. You know, they both grew up in Norfolk. And
well, that was a great congruency, too, that you had, that the car was purchased new in Norfolk, mm-hmm. And pretty much stayed in the area, which is also unusual.
It's never been owned more than 25 miles away from the original dealership at which it was sold, which is crazy.
And, you know, at least in terms of the structure, what I thought was interesting when I thought about this was, you know, you have the story of Tommy, which is really the story in a lot of ways of the building of a life, and the car, which is kind of the reverse in a lot of ways, because even though you talked about what Tommy was doing with that car, which was to take this old, basically almost junker car and try to rebuild it back to better than new. In a lot of ways, it was the story of, or at least your story is the story of the decline of that car as it goes from new through owner after owner and getting worse and worse. Whereas in a lot of ways, Tommy is, as he goes through life up until this sort of tragic moment, is getting better and better.
You could say that. You could also say that Tommy is, by the time he buys the car, the product of a restoration himself, because he has become a junker along the way and has been restored.
That's true. Well, you do point that out, that he goes through this kind of rebirth to become a better person. And the car, of course, is going through the same process.
Yeah. I mean, this is a guy, as I said, a fifth grade dropout, a guy who in his youth had very little control over his own destiny. Really very, he lived a very reactive life. You know, he got into a lot of fights, most of which, or at least a good portion of which, he didn't start, but he certainly finished. And, you know, about the only place where he found any kind of rationality, where there was a strong causation between what he did and what happened next, was under the hood of a car. It was the only place where he knew that if he turned a wrench on a certain component, he'd get the same results every time. And, you know, I think that's what really kind of drew him to cars. So, the car's decline, of course, is a byproduct of its age. It was mighty handy for me in telling the story because, you know, over the car's first 55 years, as it succumbs to decades of wear and the ravages of the weather and such, it falls into, you know, as it's passed from owner to owner, it lands in the hands of different kinds of people as it declines. You know, you wind up, what I think you see is that in addition to the socioeconomic wherewithal, or the, you know, the financial wherewithal of each character declining as the car is passed from hand to hand as it ages, you also see that their connectedness to kind of the cultural center that the car once represented, the suburban dream that a station wagon in 1957 advertised, gets more and more remote. They become more and more marginalized from that ideal until finally you get to Tommy, who is so marginalized that he's in a different solar system altogether. You know, he's out in orbit beyond Pluto and from that cultural center. And so, yeah, I mean, he's a great protagonist from a storytelling standpoint for a number of reasons. You know, he, aside completely from the fact that he's this two-fisted action adventure hero who, you know, his resume reads like Jim Croce's Bad, Bad Leroy Brown.
Well, it's true. As you imagine him, it's difficult not to think of him as a movie character, you know, like, you know, one of the tough guys that any number of very large male actors play, you know, who's capable of beating anybody and who beats everybody all the time. But he's, and you've, of course, you don't cartoonize him. You know, he's pretty real throughout, but he does feel almost mythological at certain points in the book.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the achievements or the acts that he achieved, on the way to that mythology kind of, they have a bit of a mystical quality to them in Norfolk to this day. I mean, you know, when he, this is a guy who in one bar fight slapped 10 people unconscious, not punched, slapped, because he couldn't hurt his hands at that point. He was in chemo, and he couldn't risk cutting his hands and getting an infection. So with an open hand, he slapped people out cold. You know, I mean, but that made for a memorable day in circuit court in the city of Norfolk when Tommy stood before the judge on that charge. He's an interesting character. That there are people in Norfolk who absolutely hate the man, and there are people in Norfolk who just can't get enough of him.
Well, I can imagine based on some of the things he did in his battles with the city and the in North Carolina, where he had the car lot fighting there with, I guess, the county. He certainly would not have endeared himself to the various members of state or city or local government.
Yeah, true.
And I mean, of course, then I guess, you know, maybe giving away a little bit of the story, but he does through this period of making himself kind of into a more than just a tough guy. He builds businesses. He ends up owning property. It ends up being worth millions of dollars, at least on paper, but gets caught up in the banking bubble, real estate bubble that led to the, you know, was part of the collapse of the in 2008. Let's talk a little bit about the car, because I think the car is really important. We've been talking about Tommy. He's really the protagonist, but I think the car has equal billing with Tommy Arnie. It's a 1957 Chevy Townsman station wagon, which, as you point out, is not top of the line. It's not the most rare and valuable Chevy, even from 1957, which was a year they made, probably was one of the biggest production years of all time for Chevrolet. But Chevys are pretty, 57 Chevys are iconic, and station wagons are pretty much reflective of the American dream.
Yeah, they were. I mean, they were not the frumpy grandpa mobiles in 1957 that they became, you know, 15 years later. They were the SUVs of their day.
Well, and the station wagon is emblematic of the baby boom years. You know, it didn't really exist in any large scale before World War II. You know, they were called station cars or station wagons, but they were really for the wealthy people, bodies made out of wood, you know, kind of taking you from the train station to your, you know, farmette or whatever it might be. But after World War II, station wagons became the family vehicle for the growing families of the baby boom.
Right. And really came into their own in 1956, 1957, 58. You know, that's where you saw the really big explosion in just the production of them by all the big automakers in America. And they were wildly popular, and they were viewed as a real status symbol. They were, you know, they cost more than the sedan, the comparable sedan. They were viewed as pretty sexy.
And of course, you know, today they are popular probably because of that reason. But what's interesting in a lot of ways is that you trace the various stages of ownership of a car, you know, as it goes from being new to used to even more used, you know, and becomes kind of passed down until this certain point comes, you know, at maybe 15, 20, 25 years after it was made, that it begins to look like a piece of Americana and gets to be emblematic of people's memories so it can be collectible. And a lot of the owners of your, you know, in your story fell in love with this car because of what it signified or because of how it made them feel. And they were willing and able to overlook its mechanical or physical issues. And they weren't able really, any of them, to tackle it as a job to repair or restore, because it became, at a certain point, it just becomes too massive to do.
Yeah. I mean, the first couple owners, of course, the first owner kept the car for 15 years, which was very atypical for cars at the period. You were expected to, you know, you'd hang on to a car for 3-4 years, and then you traded in. And rare was the car that rolled into six figures in any kind of decent shape in terms of mileage. You just didn't expect to get that out of a car. And by the time a car got to 55, 60,000 miles, if you didn't sell it, you were pretty much stuck with it because no one would buy it, at least under a decent price. So cars back then didn't last, and the fact that this one passed to its second owner when it was already 15 years old is pretty remarkable. But those first two owners, the original and the guy who bought it from him, and really the third two, they were all car guys who had the wherewithal to stay on top of an aging piece of machinery. Everybody who came after them was capable in descending fashion, pretty much. So as the car's troubles mechanically and aesthetically increase, the mechanical wherewithal of the succeeding owners decreases. And, you know, just it was an unfortunate kind of scissors graft that developed, where you just find as the car gets older, the owners that it attracts are more and more romantic about what it represents and less practical about owning this kind of vehicle.
Right. And of course it ends up that at a certain point, the car is abandoned, unable to drive. And I guess I think anybody who is interested in older cars has been through finding the car that is just spectacular and wonderful, but has gone so far that it is now either undrivable or virtually on its last legs. And there's this temptation, if you love old cars, to save it. And then for most people, their better judgment will overcome, and they'll realize that what's involved is probably superhuman, or super expensive, and beyond their means. So sometimes cars will be rescued by somebody who has these dreams, but can never really get it done. And in a lot of ways, this car is really lucky that it found somebody willing and able to save it.
Yeah. Oh, it, no question. Because this car was, you called it close to a junker a little while ago. It was a complete junker by 2007 when it came into Tommy Arnie's hands. He's owner 13. And it was, the previous owner got it for free as a parts car. So at the point that it came into owner number 12's hands, it was no longer a functioning independent automobile. It was an organ donor for other cars. And luckily, that 12th owner did not part it out and use its pieces. He sold it to Tommy Arnie, who decided, he knew that the car had provenance, and decided that it was worth his time and money to try to bring it back, pretty much solely because it had a provenance. He, among Tommy's many businesses, was a classic car lot down on the North Carolina-Virginia line in Moyock, North Carolina, called Moyock Muscle. And Tommy had kind of a ragtag crew that worked there and helped him restore cars, including a guy named Paul Kitchens, who is just a Michelangelo with sheet metal. The guy is phenomenal. And once I found out Tommy had the car, it took me a couple of years to track him down, and I was busy with other projects at the time. But in September of 2009, I went to see him and said, "Look, I hear that you have a car that I wrote about a few years ago for the newspaper." And he said, "Yes, I do. And as a matter of fact, we're getting ready to fix that car up." So he had already made the decision to go for it before I walked in the door. And I spent the next 3 years watching him do it.
And I will say that, and I won't talk about this too much, because I think anybody who's interested in cars ought to read particularly the part of the book about the rebuilding of the car, which takes a long time, as you said, a number of years and a lot of side trips and misadventures. But the description of some of the work that they did, I thought, was masterful and completely engrossing.
Thank you very much. It's a dicey proposition to describe, physical activity like that. And you don't know how much you can get away with without people's eyes glazing over.
Right.
The one thing I had to remind myself in terms of proportion throughout was that the ideal reader for this book was my fiance and my 20-year-old daughter, and not a guy like you or me.
That's probably true. Although I will say, I read your book simultaneously with reading A History of the Automobile Industry, a book I'm not going to say much about, because I actually thought that your book was more interesting and better captured the kind of modern concept of what cars mean. I don't mean the industry as a business, or, but more how the car and we in modern life relate to it. I thought you did that better through this story than the historical kind of comprehensive story was able to do.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you almost need to get down to the kind of the micro historical level to get into it. It's an intimate relationship that we have with our cars. I mean, we're anomalies among the peoples of the world, we Americans, in this relationship. And it's an odd one, no question about it. It's a very strange dependency / friendship / hate that we have with them. And it was fun to explore that, you know, in really what all of these people do, these 13 owners, especially Tommy Ernie, because he does devote so much time and money to trying to save this thing. I mean, what they do makes no rational sense at all. Our relationship with the car, though, is not a rational one. So it's in keeping with kind of the American way. It's just, it's a bit nutty.
That's true. No, and it, but I think that's what we like about our relationship with cars, is that they are, we combine the practical with the impractical and the romance with the mundane. I think that's what makes it interesting.
Yeah, there are trusty steeds.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Earl, for talking to me. I really appreciate it. This is David Wilk for Writer's Cast. We've been talking about Autobiography, A Classic Car, An Outlaw Motorhead, 57 Years of the American Dream. It's a book I highly recommend.
David, thank you.